Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
One of the things we're trying to do is to keep families together. When you have a large number of people in a facility like that, it does create challenges, and we're trying to do our best with it.
The White House defends conditions in a Texas jail where 200 immigrant children are being held. Attorneys for the prisoners say otherwise.
The Hutto facility is a prison, and we're holding six-month-old children there in gray drab prison scrubs.
The Hutto prison is run by the Corrections Corporation of America, one of two prisons in the country locking up immigrant families. We'll speak with a lawyer who was one of the few people allowed inside to interview families there. And we'll look at a new immigrant prison camp built as a tent city in the remote tip of southern Texas. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. More than 4 years after Congress authorized President Bush to invade Iraq, Senate Democrats have announced a new effort to try to take back that authority. Democratic leaders say they plan to unveil legislation that would repeal the 2002 resolution authorizing President Bush to go to war. The binding measure would call for withdrawal of combat units by May of next year. But the resolution would also grant leeway to keep soldiers in Iraq to fight al-Qaeda forces and train Iraqi troops. Meanwhile, House Democrats have apparently dropped plans to link further war funding to the readiness of combat forces. In Iraq today, U.S. forces are continuing a series of raids around Baghdad. Several Iraqis reported property damage and injuries after U.S. troops entered their homes. This is Sadr City resident Jafar.
They stormed our house while we were sleeping. We were afraid of them. They beat us and damaged the house on our heads. This is not a search. People did not do such things when searching. Normally, they search in a peaceful way.
In other Iraq news, a U.S. soldier has been sentenced to 100 years in prison for his role in the rape and murder of an Iraqi teen and the killing of her family last year. Sergeant Paul Cortez pleaded guilty earlier this week. He's the second soldier to be sentenced in the rape and murder of 14-year-old Abir Qasim Hamza Al-Janabi and the killing of her two parents and her five-year-old sister. Cortez could be paroled in 10 years. In Australia, Vice President Dick Cheney continued his visit down under with yet another warning against a troop withdrawal from Iraq.
The notion that free countries can turn our backs on what happens in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, or any other possible safe haven for terrorists is an option that we simply cannot indulge. If our coalition withdrew before Iraqis could defend themselves, radical factions would battle for dominance of that country.
Cheney went on to praise Australian Prime Minister John Howard for keeping Australian troops in Iraq. His comments came as polls show nearly 70% of Australians want an immediate pullout or a timetable for withdrawal. Anti-war protests continued around Cheney's visit for a second day. Hundreds of people turned out behind heavy police barricades, waving signs and chanting, "Chain up Cheney." The Guardian of London is reporting the British government is set to announce the deployment of another 1,000 British troops to Afghanistan. The increase would come just days after British Prime Minister Tony Blair announced the withdrawal of 1,600 troops from Iraq. The Bush administration has been urging NATO countries to step up troop deployments in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, Thursday, a top Afghan insurgent leader, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, compared the current fight against the U.S. military to the struggle against the Russian invasion of the 1980s.
The previous policy of the invading force in Afghanistan did not succeed, and its new policy in Afghanistan will not succeed. The occupying forces have only one option for success, and that is to pull out of Afghanistan as soon as possible, and hopefully they will choose that option without wasting time.
Hekmatyar is believed to have received hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid from the Reagan administration when he led one of the leading Mujahideen groups against the Russian occupation. The International Atomic Energy Agency has declared Iran in defiance of an international deadline to stop nuclear enrichment. On Thursday, the IAEA said Iran is operating close to 1,000 centrifuges. Experts say it would take 3,000 centrifuges running for a year to enrich weapons-grade fuel. The Bush administration immediately vowed to lead efforts to impose more sanctions at the UN Security Council. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon addressed the possibility.
I'm deeply concerned, again, that Iranian government did not meet the deadline set by the Security Council. In fact, this has been in the hands of the Security Council. Security Council has adopted a sanction measure against the Iranian, and we hoped that the Iranian government would have fully complied with all these resolutions adopted by the Security Council.
Iran responded on a different note. Iran's ambassador to the IAEA, Ali Asghar Soltaneia, called the inspector's report a vindication.
This report is the best document proving that all activities of Iran have been exclusive for peaceful purposes. In this report, it says that there is no indication of diversion for military purposes and all nuclear material have been accounted for.
The developments come amidst new doubts about the Bush administration's intelligence on Iran's nuclear activities. Diplomatic sources at the IAEA have told the Guardian newspaper much of U.S. intelligence given to U.N. inspectors has proven incorrect. The dead-end information has included a list of sites U.S. officials alleged as possible areas of illegal nuclear activity. In one case, the CIA claimed to have found plans for a nuclear warhead on a stolen government laptop supplied by an informant. Doubts were immediately raised when all the data was in English, not Farsi. In the occupied territories, a new report has found nearly half of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza are, quote, food insecure. The World Food Program study marks the first since the Bush administration led efforts to impose an international boycott on the Palestinian government following the election of Hamas. 4 out of 5 Palestinian families in Gaza reported reducing their overall spending, including food purchases. The news comes as the Bush administration has reiterated its refusal to lift the aid freeze on the Palestinian government. Other Middle East quartet members have expressed willingness to explore a softer stance, but have so far refused to back lifting the boycott. On Thursday, Hamas spokesperson Ghazi Hamad criticized the international stance.
The pressure should be imposed also on Israel's side that they denies all our national rights, they denies the borders of 67 border, they denies the right of return, they denies also the right of evacuation of all settlements. So I think it's not fair to impose a condition on the Palestinian side. At the same time, they ignore the Israeli government.
In Norway, the first international gathering for a global ban on cluster bombs is in its second day. Norwegian Foreign Affairs Minister Jonas Gahr Støre opened the conference Thursday.
The weapons we are here to discuss are indiscriminate area weapons. They cause damage that is disproportionate to their potential military effects. They do not distinguish between civilian and military targets.
The New York Times is reporting the extent of recent U.S. military involvement in the Horn of Africa is greater than previously believed. The Pentagon used a military airstrip in Ethiopia to wage airstrikes it claimed were intended to capture or kill 2 top al-Qaeda leaders in Somalia. Special forces were also deployed in parts of Somalia along with Ethiopia and Kenya. The Pentagon initially claimed success but later admitted it failed to kill or capture the 2 al-Qaeda leaders. In Egypt, the CIA extraordinary rendition victim Abu Omar has spoken out for the first time since his release from prison earlier this month. Omar is a Muslim cleric. He was kidnapped by CIA operatives in Italy and flown to Egypt, where he says he was tortured. 31 suspects, including 26 Americans, have been ordered to stand trial in Italy for the abduction. On Thursday, Abu Omar said he would return to Italy to testify.
I wish to stand before the court and explain everything to them and prove to them that I am innocent of any accusations. I am also directing my words to the Italian people, telling them that I will not give up the Italian people in their disaster, and I will stand and face any disaster they face. I will also stand with all the oppressed in the world, and I hope to work with human rights organizations to fight for the rights of the arrested all around the world.
In news from Egypt, an Egyptian blogger has been sentenced to 4 years in prison. Abdelkarim Soliman is the first blogger to stand trial in Egypt. He was brought to trial on charges of insulting Islam and President Hosni Mubarak, whom he called a dictator. Amnesty International called the ruling, quote, yet another slap in the face of freedom for expression in Egypt. In Colombia, a former director of the secret police has been arrested on charges of aiding right-wing militias in the murder of human rights workers and union activists. Jorge Noguera headed the Department of Administrative Security under President Álvaro Uribe. He's accused of supplying paramilitaries with a hit list of several names, most of whom were later killed. Noguera resigned 2 years ago amidst allegations of militia ties. Uribe later named him to a diplomatic position and defended his innocence. Back in the United States, the court trying Jose Padilla heard testimony Thursday. Padilla may now be suffering from Stockholm syndrome, in which captives identify with their captors. Forensic neuropsychiatrist Angela Haggerty made the assessment at a preliminary hearing to determine if Padilla can stand trial on charges of aiding Al-Qaeda. The Bush administration jailed Padilla without charge after initially accusing him of plotting a dirty bomb attack. Padilla was held in extreme isolation without almost any human contact for about 1,300 days and denied an attorney for nearly 2 years. The private military company Blackwater USA has announced a new venture. Total Intelligence Solutions has been founded to provide clients with CIA-like intelligence services. The company roster includes several former intelligence officials, at least two with strong Blackwater ties. The company advertises a, quote, 24/7 intelligence fusion and warning center that will help companies respond to threats and decide where to operate. The company also promises to, quote, monitor civil unrest, terrorism, economic stability, environmental and health concerns, and information technology security around the world. In media news, the Federal Communications Commission is holding its third public hearing today on media ownership. The hearing's being held in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. In Nevada, local outcry has forced the Pentagon to cancel a planned bomb test in the desert. The test would have detonated a 700-ton charge for research towards developing advanced weapons. Several local residents had filed lawsuits to stop the plans. Independent Senator Joseph Lieberman has given his strongest indication to date he could be switching to the Republican Party. In an interview with the Politico, Lieberman suggested Democratic opposition to funding the war in Iraq could lead him across the aisle. Lieberman says he has no desire to change parties, but added, quote, if that ever happens, it's because I feel the majority of Democrats have gone in a direction that I don't feel comfortable with. Senator Lieberman ran and won as an independent after losing the Connecticut Democratic nomination to challenger Ned Lamont last year. And finally, in Boston, police have announced plans to destroy their entire arsenal of pepper spray pellet guns. The weapon came under intense scrutiny 3 years ago when police shot and killed 21-year-old journalism student Victoria Snellgrove during a baseball celebration. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Human rights groups are calling for the U.S. government to shut down a jail in Texas where about 200 immigrant children, some only infants, are being detained. 10 months ago, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement began holding families in the Huddle facility in Taylor, Texas, owned by the private prison company Corrections Corporation of America. Many of the families held at the facility are seeking asylum in the United States. For months, immigration officials refused to allow outside groups or the media into the center. But late last year, researchers from the Women's Commission for Refugee Women and Children and the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service were allowed inside.
The two groups have just released a report called Locking Up Family Values, the Detention of Immigrant Families. Michelle Brené is co-author of the report. She's the director of the Detention Asylum Program at the Women's Commission for Refugee Women and Children. She joins us from Washington, D.C. And with us here in our Firehouse studio is immigration attorney Joshua Bar-David. Earlier this week, he filed a habeas petition on behalf of five members of a Palestinian family being held in another immigration prison in Texas. We repeatedly called both the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, and the Corrections Corporation of America to invite them on the program. They didn't respond to our requests. Let's begin with Michelle Brené in Washington, D.C. Can you talk about the major findings in your report, Locking Up Family Values?
Sure. We were investigating the use of family detention by ICE overall, and they're using two facilities to hold families. So we visited both facility in Berks County, Pennsylvania, and the facility that you mentioned, Hutto, in Texas. When we went to Texas, we went in on December 4th of 2006, and really what we found is that it's a former prison that is now being used to house families, and it still looks and feels very much like a prison. And even though they've made some modifications to accommodate children, such as putting railings on the bunk beds and painting some murals, it doesn't really change the fact that it's a prison, and people in there are treated still very much like prisoners.
And the people who are being detained here, are these folks who have entered the country illegally, or are they largely asylum applicants?
We weren't able to get exact statistics on what percentage of the people being held there are asylum seekers, but it does appear that the majority of them are seeking asylum. Everybody who's there is in some sort of immigration proceeding. Either they've been apprehended at the border crossing illegally, or some of them have been apprehended on the inside the country. And I think your other guest can speak to his clients in that case. So there's people in all sorts of proceedings. But what is interesting is that none of the people held at these facilities have any criminal charges pending against them, nor do they have any criminal backgrounds.
Can you give us, Michelle Brené, a historical context for locking up whole families?
Sure. It's a fairly new thing to lock up families together as family units. The Department of Homeland Security used to separate families, and before that, INS. They sometimes held families in hotel rooms, but for the most part, families were either released pending a hearing, or what they started to do post 9/11 more, as they kind of were ending the practice of releasing people to the community, was separating families. So they would take the adults in the family and put them in adult facilities. The mother in a facility for women, the father in a male facility, and the children would be transferred to the Department of Health and Human Services, the Office for Refugee Resettlement, who takes custody of unaccompanied children in these proceedings. And they would be responsible for them until the case was resolved. When Congress heard about this, they expressed concern about separating families and instructed ICE to stop separating families. And actually what they recommended was that ICE use alternatives, such as a program that currently exists that is run by ICE called the Intensive Supervised Appearance Program. And what they recommended also was that if these programs couldn't be used and detention was necessary, that home-like non-penal environments be used.
And could you tell us about the conditions that you found in these centers, and specifically the impact on the children of being locked up?
Sure. I mean, the facility in Hutto in particular is, I don't think it can be described anywhere near a home-like non-penal environment. As I mentioned, it is a former prison that still looks and feels very much like a prison. Children, families sleep in cells at night where children are very often separated from their parents. So at night, some children do remain in the cell with their parents, and others are separated into separate cells. It depends on family size, space, and the age of the child. But children as young as 6 can be separated at night. And in fact, at the Berks County facility, all children over 5 sleep separately from their parents. And at night, these parents cannot get to their children. So many parents talked of their children crying at night or being sick at night and not being able to go to them. While the doors of the cells at the Hutto facility are not locked, they've disengaged the locks on the cell doors. There is a laser beam that shoots across the line of cells so that if a door is opened, an alarm would go off.
We're talking with Michelle Brené, who is one of the people who just published this report, Locking Up Family Values, the Detention of Immigrant Families. Joshua Bardavid is also with us, immigration lawyer here in New York. Can you talk about your clients, the Hazaza family?
The Hazaza family is actually being held at a different facility than the Hutto facility. They're being held in Haskell, Texas, the Rolling Plains Regional Detention Center. Two members of the Hazaza family were held at Hutto but have since been released, the mother and an 11-year-old child. The remaining members of the family are being held in what is a county prison that holds violent criminal offenders who are there, some of whom were there for life. They are being held in absolute prison-like facility.
I'm going to break in for 1 minute because we have just gotten a call from the Hutto detention facility. We're joined on the phone by an Iranian immigrant named Majid from inside the Hutto detention center in Taylor, Texas. He, his wife, his 9-year-old son, Kevin, have been held at the center for the past 19 days. Majid, your story is quite a remarkable one. Can you tell us how you ended up at this Texas jail?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I was in my way to go to train to Canada, and my plane was, after 3 hours in the flight, somebody was died in the plane and had emergency landing to Puerto Rico. After that, they said everybody should come out. After that, we went out. Immigration, they said you need to have American visa. We had no American visa. And they held us over there.
Just to be clear, you were never planning to end up in the United States. Is that right? You were flying to Canada, but another passenger on the plane had a heart attack, and so you guys had a forced landing in Puerto Rico. And when you had to come out of the plane while he was taken off the plane, that's when they took you.
Yeah, this happened, yeah. It was a Canadian Zoom airline, and our ticket was direct from Guyana to Toronto. And this happened, they hold us over. My son is Canadian, both child is 9.5 years old. And they put on a detention in Puerto Rico, and from Monday to Friday, I was in the jail in Puerto Rico between criminal people. And my wife and son was other place. We had no news from each other from Monday morning until Friday at noon until we see each other in Puerto Rico airport. After that, they brought us here to Hutto Detention Center. And here we are in the same part but different room. My wife and my son is room, but it's toilet inside the room, uncovered toilet. My son has asthma, and it's very bad smell comes here. It's very horrible here, and we are very bad situation. We need help. We need the people help me.
Majid, in other words, basically, what reason did they give you for holding you if you never intended to enter the United States at all? What reason did they give for locking you up?
Because they said you have an American visa. That's why you have to stay here. Just the plane was waiting 1 hour for us, but they didn't let us. Few officer came, they said immigration officer 6-7. They said, we're going to send you, but let us make decision. After that, they called the police chief. They came there. He said, let me think 5 minutes. After 5 minutes, he came. He said, I'm going to send you to Canada, but I'm afraid to lose my job. But usually we have to send with your plane, but we keep you here. America is much better than Canada. Here you have safer place. We send you to hotel, and after a few days, you're going to be free. But they broke their promise. That's why they keep us here, and we have very bad situation here.
Do you know whether any other passengers on your plane were also detained in the same way, or was your family the only one, as far as you can tell?
The only my family, no other passenger.
I just want to say to our listeners and viewers, we are not giving your full name. We're not showing your face at your request. You did apply for political asylum in Canada in the past when you lived there for 10 years. You were ultimately denied, sent back to Iran. And what happened when you were sent back to Iran, you and your wife?
Yeah, in December 2005, we sent it to Iran, the whole family, when my Canadian son born. And all documents, the immigration officer give all documents to the captain of plane. After that, in Italy, we went with all Italian airline. In Italy, police came to plane. They took us in one room in the transit of Italy. And after that, again, they put us in the plane and give all documents to the captain of all Italian again. We went to Iran. And in Iran, the plane, this captain said, you have to sit until the police come to take you. All passengers went out, and four Iranian secret police came in plane, and he got all documents from the captain, and they took us in the airport in the secret police officer. We were there for a few hours, 4 or 5 hours in the same room. After that, they separated us. They took me to other place, unknown place. I was in one small cell for 6 months, and lots of torture and hitting. Now I have testicle problem, a knee problem, and lots of things. And they took my wife to other prison, but we have no news from each other. And for 6 months, my wife was 1 month in the prison, and she boarded, after she was free, she boarded a child, and because they hit him, and she was sexually assaulted 2-3 times in the jail, and it's a very bad situation. But we had no news from each other. They told my wife, we killed your husband. You have to cooperate with us.
They said they killed you?
Yeah, a few times told. One time they told her, he's in coma. The other time they said, already he was killed. And, you know, many times they played with her. After 1 month, they freed her in the street at night time. They did with me too. After 6 months, lots of torture. And this one, they freed me in the street out of the town with closed eyes. And I didn't see anybody, but they took me in daytime Saturday in winter. You know, they take my pants out to put in, you know, very cold water. The ice broke the ice to put in the water. And they hit me every day, hitting me. And when I came out, I was less than 30 kilograms, my weight. And my wife was different. 6 months was under psychologist medication over there. And after three, I should register 2 times a week, every Sunday and Thursday. And when they took me over there, again, 1 week they put me in detention, and the other time, again, 3 days. And after that, one guy told me, I'm going to help you. After that, called me, said, okay, your future is very dangerous. You have to leave. Otherwise, you are in big trouble. I don't know what happened to you and your family. That's why we decided and we escaped.
Tried to go to Canada. Can you put your son, Kevin, on? He's standing next to me, next to you, 9 years old.
Yes. Just hold on, please.
Thank you. We're talking to Majid and Kevin in the Hutto Detention Center that's run by the Corrections Corporation of America.
Hello.
In Taylor, Texas. Hi, Kevin. How are you?
Not good.
Can you tell us the situation you're in right now and what you want to happen right now?
Excuse me, I didn't hear you.
Can you describe where you are right now?
I'm in U.S. jail right now.
And Kevin, where are you staying at night? Are you with your parents, or are they locking you up separately?
I'm with my parents, but we're in separate rooms.
In separate rooms?
Yeah.
Are they letting you? Are you getting any kind of education, or are you just sitting in your cell all day?
We're sitting in the cell all day.
What do you want to do now, Kevin?
I want to be free. I want to go outside. I want to go to school. I want to be in my homeland, Canada.
You want to go home to Canada?
What?
You want to go home to Canada?
Yeah, my home is in Canada.
Were you with your parents in Iran?
My parents? What?
Were you with your mother and father in Iran?
Yeah.
And you were coming on the plane?
Yeah.
What are the people telling you? Can you go to Canada?
Hmm?
What are the guards telling you? Will they release you?
I forgot what they were saying, but they told us some stuff, but I forgot what they were saying to us.
How are the other children there? Are you spending time with any of the other children?
No.
They don't let you spend time with the other children?
No.
I'm
sleeping beside the washroom, and I can't. And I'm upstairs. I can't go to the washroom all the time. And there's a lot of smell coming out from the washroom, and the food is garbage, and the school is very bad. I can't learn anything good. And I have asthma, and I got sick in here. I can't stay here anymore.
Kevin, you said you're sleeping next to the bathroom?
Yeah. Mm. And it's not a separate room. It's right beside the bed. And I'm sleeping beside the wall, and my back gets sick and it hurts.
How is your mother?
My mother is sick.
Kevin, can you put your father back on the phone?
Okay.
Kevin is 9 years old. He's a Canadian citizen, came from Iran with his parents. They were flying over the United States when the plane had to land in Puerto Rico because a passenger had a heart attack. And when they landed, the Majid family, or not using their real name, was taken off the flight. Majid, have you talked to the Canadian consulate? And what is your hope when you get to Canada? If you get to Canada.
Yeah, on Monday they came here. They said they come here and we spoke to each other. They mostly asked regarding Kevin, what's your food and what kind of food they give you? Are you in same room with family? My son said no, because he said, I was told all your family in one room. We said no, we are separate rooms. And the toilet is inside, the uncovered toilet in the room. And only they said, speak regarding this one, said, you're going to help us. They said, we don't know, you have to speak with your lawyer. But after that, just we got information, my son's birth certificate information, and they left. And 2 days ago, I tried to call them in council, and no response, because he was on the phone. I tried again, but I couldn't reach him. And no more information I have.
Majid, now, do you have a lawyer who is helping you, and do you have a scheduled hearing anytime in the future on your case?
Yeah, I have lawyers. This is from immigration clinic here. The students, they're working. They are very good people. And no hearing. 2 or 3 times I requested for hearing, but no response so far in past 17, 18 days here. No response. We don't know what's going to happen for us.
Do you want to stay in the United States?
You know, we escaped from Iran, okay? We escaped to be safe and free with my family. But our plan was in Canada. And I don't know, they keep us here. Anyway, we want safe and free, Canada or U.S. If Canada give us a visa, go there, we go to U.S. It's here, we stay here.
Why are you afraid to use your full name? Or to show your face?
Because everybody knows the Irans. The Irans, like this, we are in a very bad situation. Because I don't trust here immigration. Because the first time they said lots of things to us, but they broke their promise. They said, you're going to happen this. But now we said, we're going to deport it. Okay, maybe we deport it. And we are like this, we are in 100% in danger. Oh. In our whole full name goes is 200% in danger, because especially in the United States, if you go from mother country, you have less risk with government. If you go from United States, because they said U.S. is our enemy, they said Iranian authorities says, okay? Mm-hmm. But that's why we are more and more trouble if you go back, because they said, why you go to U.S.? And this happened.
Joshua Bardavid is an attorney that we are sitting with in the New York studio. When you listen to this story, what are your thoughts?
Unfortunately, this is what he is experiencing is a very common experience. It is the reflexive use of detention for asylum seekers. The Majid family, they're survivors from what he's describing. He's a survivor of torture. He was detained in Iran. He is seeking freedom, in this case in Canada. Arrives in the United States and is placed back in detention. The re-traumatizing effects of being placed back in detention cannot be underestimated. You have a child who is sleeping in what was a jail cell for a maximum security prison that has been converted, but they still leave the exposed toilet, you know, sitting in the middle of the room. There's no privacy with other children. He's in a room separate from his parents. Now, the door may be not locked at night, but that door is certainly shut, and it's a steel-heavy door. They are placed in a prison. There is no doubt that this is a prison. And what is particularly troubling about this is that this was designed for the purpose of holding families, yet they made a conscious decision to maintain the facility as a prison, to leave the barbed wire, to leave the doors, to leave the environment as a prison.
And what about the issue, I don't know if you found with other of your clients, given the fact that you do have young children like this, you'd think that there'd be some kind of process for expedited hearing to find out, have an immigration judge review the case. But they've been there now, what, more than 2 weeks now?
Yeah, that's definitely another troubling aspect. In order to sentence somebody in the United States to 2 weeks in jail, you would need to have guilt proved beyond a reasonable doubt by a jury of your peers. In order for the Majid family to spend an additional 2 weeks in jail, it simply could take an administrative delay. This is one of the problems.
I want to ask you about the role of these private prison companies. The Hutto facility is run by CCA, the Corrections Corporation of America. In fact, the jail is named after CCA's co-founder, T. Don Hutto. I want to play a comment made by William Andrews, the chair of the CCA board, during a conference call with investors 2 weeks ago.
I don't want to leave anybody the impression that these facilities that are being reported in the paper of ICE are in any way substandard. In fact, they're above standard, and the reports come from special interest groups that are attempting to do away with privatization and the whole immigration situation. And, you know, we welcome anybody to visit our facilities, and the family facility, particularly at T. Don Hutto, is almost like a home.
That was William Andrews, the chair of the board of the Corrections Corporation of America, describing the conditions at the Hutto jail as, quote, almost like a home. Michelle Brené in Washington, D.C., your response.
Well, as I mentioned already and has been made very clear by your other guests, it is very clearly a prison that is being used to house inmates, and it has no resemblance to a home. I mean, there's sofas, there are plastic sofas and TVs, but that's about it. And one of the things that's very disturbing about this model that they're using is that there are alternatives. As I mentioned before, there are pre-hearing release programs that could be used. There's a whole range of ways to ensure that people appear for hearings, that they don't abscond, and that, you know, enforcement of our immigration laws can be accomplished without resorting to these drastic measures. And that's one of the things that we've really been stressing in the report is that, you know, as you've heard from the responses and the White House response and ICE response to our report and to other complaints about the Hutto facility, they're presenting it as an alternative of either a facility like this or complete separation into different buildings and different centers of entire families. And there is a wide range of other alternatives in between those two.
I want to thank you both for being with us. I also want to thank Majid and Kevin, and we will certainly continue to cover their story and update you on the situation. For one brief moment, because they called in the middle of you describing your own clients, if you could briefly finish, Joshua, and then we're going to go to Raymondville, to something that is, well, a tent city, a prison camp for immigrants in the tip of Texas, but very briefly.
Well, my clients now, the Hazaza family, who are being held in Haskell, which is a county facility and is a maximum security facility. This is an entire family that, again, is being separated in this center in extremely harsh conditions. That includes isolation of a 17-year-old who was now turned 18, but at the time he was 17 when he was placed in solitary confinement. You have there's physical threats. There is strip searches as a common tool of discipline. And it is a prison, and this is an ongoing problem of intermingling immigration detainees with criminal violent offenders in the United States.
And again, the reason for their detention, are they asylum seekers?
They were asylum seekers. They lost their asylum hearing, but the U.S. government has been unable to remove them, so they do not know what to do with them, so they placed them in this facility.
I want to thank you, Joshua Bardavid, for joining us. Juan?
Well, the number of undocumented immigrants currently imprisoned in the United States has reached a record of more than 26,000 people. To keep pace with the increasing number of detainees, the government is rapidly expanding its federal immigration detention system. The largest immigrant prison camp is in Raymondville, Texas, in the remote southern tip of the state. Some 2,000 undocumented immigrants are currently being held in the prison awaiting deportation. The $65 million jail was built last summer by the Management Training Corporation.
The Washington Post describes the Raymondville facility as a futuristic tent city made of Kevlar-like material without windows, ringed by barbed wire. Many of those being held there say they have insufficient food, clothing, medical care, and access to the outside world. We're going to go to break, and then we'll be back. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We hope to go down to Raymondville, Texas. We're trying to reach our guest. But in the meantime, I want to turn to another story about immigrants. Hundreds of people gathered at New York University Thursday to protest a game called Find the Illegal Immigrant, organized by the school's Republican Club. Democracy Now! Producer Elizabeth Press was at the protest and spoke to Caitlin Canal, secretary of the NYU College Republicans. She also talked to Sasha Hamed of the Students Creating Radical Change.
We decided about a month ago that we were going to hold an event. It's the Find the Illegal Immigrant. And essentially what goes behind the game is people can sign up between the hours of 11 and 2 to be INS agents. And then at 2 o'clock, one of our members is going to be walking around with a illegal immigrant sign. And the person who finds them gets a gift card. We decided this about a month ago that we wanted to do this event. It was one of many events that we decided, you know, we thought about. We put it up to a vote, and the majority voted that we wanted to do this event. So this is not, I really hope that people don't focus in on a few people of this group and really ostracize them for this, because that's not the case at all. This was a group effort. And our motivation behind this is essentially that we wanted to raise awareness and incite a little dialogue on campus here, because unfortunately, in such a polar university, the conservative voice is often lost.
Okay, my name is Sasha Hamad. I'm an NYU student. I'm from a progressive club called Students Creating Radical Change on campus. And I'm one of the organizers of the counter-protest of the NYU College Republicans game, which is titled Find the Illegal Immigrant. And we came out against this because the language and the images that the NYU Republicans were using to publicize this event target Mexicans through cartoons, through photographs, playing on popular discourse that, you know, illegal immigrants are all people of color, you know, furthering the government's criminalization and racial profiling of, you know, anyone of color. So we came out here today you know, in solidarity with immigrants, regardless of legal status, which is why we're wearing our tags. So we're here to question, you know, why is NYU tolerating this sort of racism on campus to show solidarity with immigrants and, you know, to engage about a larger dialogue and educate our communities that immigrants are what make this country run.
Voices from New York University yesterday. Juan Gonzalez, you wrote your column in the New York Daily News today on this. You were there.
Yes, it got enormous, enormous press coverage. I was astounded by the number of cameras down there, but it clearly shows the trivialization after what the segments we've just seen of the problems that real-life immigrants are having in this country in these detention centers, trivializing the entire issue of illegal immigration and the problems there. And I particularly focused on a Chinese-American student who was part of the College Republicans and who clearly did not know anything about the history of racially motivated exclusion of Chinese in this country for so many years by American policy on immigration. And I think it was a real clear sense, though, that the vast majority of the students that were there were protesting this trivialization of the immigration issue.
Well, staying with the immigration issue for another minute, we're going to go now to Jody Goodwin, who's an immigration lawyer from Harlingen, Texas, about 20 miles from the Raymondville prison, that huge tent city. She represents a number of immigrants being held there. She's joining us on the phone today from Houston. Jody Goodwin, you're one of the few lawyers who've gotten into this facility. Can you describe what it is?
Well, it looks like a large series of circus tents put up in the middle of the field. There's a cement foundation and a steel frame, like ribs, and then there's canvas that's stretched over the steel frame, and there's 10 tents just like that all in a row.
Jody Goodwin, I'm very familiar with Raymondville and Willacy County. It's one of the poorest counties in the United States, largely Mexican-American. Any sense of the reaction of the surrounding community to the erection of this enormous detention center?
Well, it's interesting, the reaction of the community, because it's mixed. One of the poorest counties in the United States, in the Rio Grande Valley in general, in the five-county area, is the poorest area in the United States. So the thought of a vast employment, which the prison did provide, I think was welcomed by the community because it provided a wealth of jobs for an area that has high unemployment. Now, there's questions about the training that was available prior to the prison opening, and even still, you know, whether or not the people that were hired have appropriate training as of yet.
Can you talk about the people you represent in Raymondville? You call, what is it that you call it, RITMO?
Now made famous by the Washington Post, yeah.
Taking after Gitmo, Guantanamo. What kind of access to food, to health care? What is their treatment by the guards?
Well, I think generally the access to health care is good, but there have been rampant reports and repeated reports. I can't say whether these are isolated incidences or not, but there are repeated reports of my client and other people that I've talked to at the detention center that aren't my clients that indicate they would put in requests for sick call to be seen by a doctor or one of the nurses at the public health service, and days would go by before those requests would be answered. Now, I know that ICE has responded to those types of complaints by saying that, you know, that's just not true, but I have heard repeatedly from my clients and those who are not my clients that that's the case. I've also heard repeatedly and over time that food service is not consistent in terms of the timing that food is served, that the quantity of the food that is being served is not fulfilling. I mean, I went to the detention center once about probably the last part of November last year, and I walked into one of the pods, and I just opened the door and said, "Buenos días, ¿cómo están todos?" And they responded to me, "Muriendo de hambre," we're dying of hunger. And, you know, this is just their immediate reaction to someone coming in and asking, how are you? Now, ICE has responded that they are providing food within the, you know, caloric limit that's approved by dietary services, et cetera, et cetera. But even recently, as most recently as 2 weeks ago, I had a client write to me a pleading letter asking for medical attention and decent food because he'd been served rancid milk days in a row, and he and other detainees in his pod were throwing up and had stomach problems because they had been served spoiled food. So, you know, for whatever that's worth, I know ICE's comments are completely opposite to that, but that's what the reports that I get from my clients and from detainees there.
Jody Goodwin, any sense of how long the average detainee is being held there? Clearly, after the Marielle boat lift years ago or decades ago now, some of the Cuban migrants were held for years in detention by United States Immigration. What's the situation there?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the facility went up so quickly. It was contracted in, you know, mid-June, and it was housing 500 detainees by mid-August. It was at least designed to be a temporary facility, and I'm not really sure what's the number limitation that ICE would use to refer to temporary. I've seen many, many people detained at the facility 2, 3, 4, 5 months, and then there are people that are detained at the facility that have been transferred around the country and eventually end up in Willacy County, probably because it's cheaper to house detainees down in Willacy County than it is in places like New York or Boston. But I've seen those people that come into Willacy County after already having been in immigration detention in various facilities around the country 5, 6 months. I saw a woman from Ghana that had been transferred around from 5 different facilities in an 8-month period of time, and she was supposedly only waiting to be deported. So why does it take 8 months and 5 facilities to deport somebody to Ghana? I'm not really sure.
Can we talk for a minute about who built this facility, Management Corporation of America, a private company, and how it compares to the public prisons or ones run by the Department of Homeland Security?
Wow. Well, actually, Management Training Corporation is a contractor who runs the operations of the facility. It was a different contractor who actually constructed the facility, and I can't remember the name of that that contractor. It was a contractor out of Houston, actually. And as far as how does it compare to ICE-run facilities? Oh, night and day. We have an ICE-run facility that's a fairly large detention center that's only about 45 minutes away from the Raymondville facility. That's the Port Isabel Detention Center. And that's an ICE-run facility as opposed to a contractor-run facility. And you compare the two, and Port Isabel is Club Med compared to Raymondville. In fact, when there's discipline problems or when someone starts complaining about their conditions at Port Isabel, I mean, almost as a joke, but really and truly, it's not taken in jest, they say, well, do you want me to send you to Port to Willacy? You know, the people would rather stay at Port Isabel than be sent to Willacy.
What do you think, Jody Goodwin, has to happen right now?
Well, we need immigration reform. I think that there needs to be a comprehensive approach to reform, and you know, reform has to encompass a lot of different aspects. We can't just settle on a guest worker program. We can't just focus on enforcement. I mean, the reform aspect needs to encompass the people who are here. Needs to encompass the need of American companies for workers. It needs to encompass enforcement and just enforcement of the laws. It needs to have all of those aspects to be able to be effective. And I have high hopes that Congress can set aside some of their partisanship and do something that will actually work good, and be acceptable to both sides of the issue.
And what is your sense in a state like Texas and the other border states in your part of the country that clearly most most feel the impact of the immigration issue in terms of the willingness of both Democrats and Republicans this year to come up with some comprehensive immigration reform?
Well, it's interesting. I've met with staffers in Washington D.C. and talked to different representatives and senators with respect to the proposals. I think that there's a clear recognition by all of the border representatives in Congress that there's a problem that needs to be dealt with. And the mere fact that they're willing to start a dialogue on the issue, I think, is hopeful. It's gotten to a point that it's crisis situations. So those individuals are, I think, finally realizing that they need to take action now that they've recognized the issue.
Jody Goodwin, I want to thank you for being with us, immigration lawyer from Harlingen, Texas, representing immigrants held in the Raymondville prison, about 20 miles from Harlingen. She was speaking to us from Houston. Juan, as we wrap up today, there was an interesting editorial in the New York Times called They Are America that began almost a year ago. Hundreds of thousands of immigrant workers and their families slipped out from the shadows of American life and walked boldly in daylight through Los Angeles, Washington, Chicago, New York, and other cities. We are America, their banners cried. The crowds, determined but peaceful, swelled into an immense sea. The nation was momentarily stunned. And it goes on to talk about a lot that has happened since then. The country summoned great energy to confront the immigration problem, but most of it has been misplaced, crudely and evenly applied. Border enforcement, what little the last Congress did about immigration was focused on appeasing hardline conservatives by appearing to seal the border. President Bush's new budget continues that approach, seeking 3,000 more Border Patrol officers and another $1 billion for a 700-mile fence, adding to the billions spent to militarize the border since the 1990s. That still isn't enough to build the fence, and it hasn't controlled the illegal flow. They say you need more visas and better workplace enforcement to do that. It's directed much traffic into the remote Southwest desert, making more immigrants vulnerable to smugglers and leaving many people dead. And then there's the federal raids, like the Swift packing plant, the local crackdowns, the gutted due process, the web of suspicion, the rise of hate.
Well, I think the reality is that, yes, there was a lot of attention last year, but nothing really emerged in terms of comprehensive immigration reform. And I do not see at this stage that there is any big momentum already in this new year by this new Congress to address the immigration issue. And I think it's going to clearly necessitate another upsurge of mass protest to be able to even put it on the agenda. And I suspect that this spring we're going to see more of that.
I mean, it's interesting that the main goal of people who are organizing the protest was just to stop any immigration legislation from passing because they felt in a Republican Congress there could only be trouble. And yet now the Democrats are in power. What have they done? And is it on their agenda?
No, as I said, I don't think it is right now. And I think it's going to be necessitate both the corporations who are increasingly realizing the necessity to have comprehensive immigration reform, as well as a mass movement and the labor movement to put it on the agenda. Because otherwise, with the war and the other major issues confronting the country right now, it's going to be continue to be pushed back in terms of addressing what is clearly needed is some kind of comprehensive immigration reform.
Well, we're going to link to your story on the NYU protest, Find an Illegal Immigrant. The Republican Club held it, and hundreds of students then wore little notes on them that said, illegal immigrant. Is that right?
Yes, I am.
I am an illegal immigrant. We are wrapping up right now. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdo-Kadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Aaron Matei, Jen Utes, Anna Noguera, Anuradha Bhagwati, Megan Whitney, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Noguera are our engineers. Special thanks to Angela Alston, Uri Galed, Rebecca Silver, Kieran Krugmeadows, Jillian O'Connor, Jerome Bourgeois, Samantha Chambly. Our website is democracynow.org. We have a TV producer job opening, knowledge of Final Cut, TV experience, Photoshop. You can go to our website to get the details or email us at job@democracynow.org, your resume. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!